Number 56, Lear Incorporated petitioner versus John S. Atkins. Mr. Hale.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. We're assembling a few exhibits that we expect to demonstrate to the court at a later point during the argument. This case is here on writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court of the State of California. In simplest form, the case is concerned with a patent license agreement between Petitioner Lear and Respondent Atkins, and the validity and enforcement under this agreement of patent rights, a patent which ultimately issued to Respondent. The Supreme Court of California has upheld this license agreement to the practical effect that the patent is immune from challenge of validity, and also to the practical effect that established federal criteria need not govern the determination of the scope of the patent when it's enforced under the agreement in question. What we are asking this court is to rule that the patent laws and the protection afforded by them cannot be so extended by private agreement between individual parties. We're asking that this court rule that patent rights cannot be so extended under state law so as to render the validity and interpretation of the scope of the patent immune to the criteria of the federal patent laws.
Well, does the so-called Michigan patent here really, a Michigan device, really involve a question under the patent law?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is from the California, I think I've got them straightened out. The Michigan device up to the time of notice of termination anyway, was not patented, was it?
No, Your Honor.
And was it patented and up through the stipulated time for the cutoff on damages for purposes of this litigation?
No, Your Honor, there was one patent. It was directed to the device that has been identified as the California Model 2156 Gyro.
Now that was the so-called California.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm talking only about Michigan, which...
Yes.
Well, it's a large sum of money. I don't want to anticipate your argument.
Well, Your Honor mentioned...
Don't bother to answer me now, but as you go along, I trust you will.
Yes, Your Honor.
I brought it up at this time because of the nature of your opening statement, but it's bothered me since I first studied this case, whether and the extent to which this is truly a question involving the patent laws of the United States, or whether, at least so far as the Michigan patent is concerned, it's a contract question, perhaps under antitrust laws generally.
Yes,
I don't want to interfere with your planned argument, but that is a basic problem in my mind in this case.
Yes. Well, Your Honor, that really highlights the federal issues that are before this court in that... There was one patent, and it disclosed essentially the structure of the California Model 2156 Gyro. The Michigan structure was independently developed at a different facility in view of the procedures that were used in assembling the California gyros and the Michigan gyros. The Michigan gyros were originally included as coming within the scope of the patent application and hence the agreement. So an interpretation of the scope of the patent application, the patent, are very basic to this question that's before the court. Likewise, whether or not Lear has the right to challenge the validity of this patent raises very basic federal issues before this court. The California Supreme Court based its decision solely under the terms of a license agreement that was entered into between the parties in 1955. And the California Supreme Court felt that we're not concerned with defenses which might be available to Lear in determining questions of validity and infringement. The California Supreme Court apparently felt that the agreement was supreme. It need not be concerned with the details of federal law that control patent matters. The court even went so far as to say valid claims are not required. We submit that parties should, it's against public policy for parties to collaborate and exploit patent rights regardless of validity. Under the circumstances of this case, if Lear and Adkins had so desired, they could have joined forces, paid no attention to whether or not the patent was valid or not, but enforced it by sheer economic power, and the public interest certainly would not be served by such an arrangement. The California court also went so far as to say it doesn't matter how this patent was obtained through the patent office. If a patent ever issues, well, that's all we're concerned about. We don't care whether new matter was added in violation of federal rules, decisions of this court, for example. The California court said we're not concerned with whether or not fraud was practiced on the patent office. We submit that those raise very, very basic federal issues, Your Honor. Such a decision results in extension of patent rights far beyond the rights that would be available in an infringement action. It also permits individual states to employ standards in patent matters that differ from state to state. For example, as matters stand today, the law in California concerning licensee estoppel is exactly contra to the law in the state of Minnesota, as stated by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1954 in the case of Crew versus Flanagan, which is cited in our briefs. Well, the ultimate result of the decision of the California Supreme Court is the enforcement of a patent which the trial court in California found to be invalid as a matter of law for failure to meet the constitutional standard required for patentability. We submit that an agreement, basing a decision solely upon an agreement, whereby patent rights are so extended, is against public policy, against the policies and provisions of both the patent laws and the antitrust laws. If an agreement can be employed to circumvent the constitutional standard required for patentability, uniform federal standards cannot be maintained in the 50 states. And this is a striking example of one state that is out of step with some other states. The most significant dates and events that are involved in this case are set forth in the chart
I have behind the lectures.
And I will refer to these dates during my argument. The Adkins patent application in the subject matter in suit was filed in February of 1954. The agreement was entered into in September 1955. It is the first document in Appendix 2 of the record, which we reproduced. The rights and the obligations of the parties under this agreement are based on the claims set forth in the patent application, which was filed by Adkins in 1954. But only to the extent that the claims are patentable. The agreement is very explicit in this regard. Lear agreed to pay royalties on its products that employ the invention that is defined by the claims that are patentable. Now, contrary to the repeated assertions of Adkins that the agreement was based upon his secret ideas, discoveries, and unpatentable things, the California Supreme Court expressly based its decision on Adkins' patent rights under this agreement. For example, in Appendix 1 at page 192, the California Supreme Court said, "The agreement clearly sets forth that royalties are to be paid only for patented or patentable claims which Lear utilized in its products." Now, although the agreement and the patent application cover several devices and features, only the feature of bearing alignment, supporting bearings in alignment for a rotatable device is involved in this action. The technical subject matter is almost identical with that which was before this court many years ago in Singer versus Kramer, which is cited in our briefs. Now, the patent application and the patent which ultimately issued are also reproduced in Appendix 2 at pages 18 and 32. The circumstances under which this dispute arose was that Adkins was employed by Lear in 1951 under an agreement which permitted him to retain title to certain inventions. This was covered by a preliminary agreement which was never admitted in evidence because it was superseded and canceled by the 1955 agreement, which is item number 2 in my chart. Lear had two facilities at that time. One was in California and the other one was in Michigan, and Adkins did his work in the California facility, and he developed, along with other Lear employees, this Model 2156 gyro. At the same time, Mr. Kuristan in Michigan was developing the so-called Michigan gyro. And in 1955, Lear started manufacturing and selling both of these devices, and they were both employed in military equipment, almost exclusively in military equipment. And when the license agreement was consummated, the patent application was directed primarily to the way the devices were assembled. And as I mentioned earlier in response to Mr. Justice Fortas' question, the two products were included as covered by the agreement at that time because of the similarity of the methods. In 1957, Lear conducted a search of prior art, and it found that this method couldn't be patentable to Adkins. It called the prior art to his attention, and at that time it renounced any further liability on the Michigan steel gyros. That's item number 3. Now, the patent application was rejected several times and amended several times. And one amendment of particular importance is that of December 1958. Prior to this amendment, the application was directed to the characteristic features of the Model 2156 gyros. Subsequent to this amendment, it was directed primarily to the characteristic features of the Michigan steel gyros. For example, prior to the amendment, the application did not say one word about removable bearings. Yet, subsequent to the amendment, the application contained such wording, and Adkins has relied very heavily on that added wording in briefs before the California Supreme Court and also before this court, emphasizing this very feature that was added by amendment many years later. In early 1959, the claims directed to bearing alignment were under rejection by the Patent Office. All of them were under rejection. The application had been pending for 5 years. Lear had not received what it bargained for under this executory contract, which was some patent rights. So on April 8, 1959...
Are you talking now about both of them?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm talking about the entire agreement, which the agreement, the Lear's position as of April 1959, was that we have stopped paying royalties as of 1957 because...
On what?
On the Michigan steel gyros, but they continued to pay royalties on the California gyros.
Well, I just have the greatest difficulty in this case when you talk about both of them together.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because if I understand what I've read in the briefs, there are differences in fact that may be material in a way with respect to California and Michigan.
Yes.
Now that chart you've got up there relates only to Michigan, does it?
Well, no, Your Honor. As of this date,
yeah, that
1955,
license.
The two products were listed as covered.
Right.
As of this date, Lear said, our search reveals you cannot possibly get claims covering the process, so we're going to cease paying royalties.
We on Michigan.
On the Michigan. We're going to continue on the California Model
right.
2156. And right here is where we come into the scope question of enforcement of the patent under state law, Your Honor. As of this date, Lear says, well, we don't seem to be getting anything. We've been carrying this agreement for years. No patent is issued. We don't think it's going to be any good once it does issue. So we're going to terminate the agreement. And Lear served a notice of termination
as
under...
As to both?
As to both. As to the whole work, Your Honor. Under express provisions of the agreement, one of the agreements says Lear shall have the right on 90 days prior written notice to terminate any of the licenses in this agreement. And Lear said, all right, we have the right, we terminate the whole works.
Well, that right as to terminate, was that confined to a situation in which patent did not issue?
No, Your Honor, that provision appears in Section 2A of the license agreement. It's on page 4. If I may direct your attention to the specific... It's on page 4 of Appendix A2, the large. Section Paragraph 2A, the very last... very last sentence, it's about two-thirds of the way down the page. It says, Lear shall have the right on 90 days prior written notice to Adkins to terminate any one or more of the licenses herein granted. Yes, Your Honor. The state court, upon considering that specific sentence, said, we find an implied condition that requires that you cease manufacturing these devices before you can terminate. Now, this did not arise below in the trial level. The trial court said the agreement was terminated. clear exercise its rights. The Intermediate Appellate Court said the same thing. California Supreme Court found this implied condition, and it is our position, Your Honor, that such an implied condition is most certainly contrary to the purposes and provisions of the patent and antitrust laws. This is a circumstance that arose only upon the decision of the California Supreme Court.
So, as of April 8, 1959, it was Lear's position that the entire agreement was canceled, which covered both of the products. Now, some 8 or 9 months later, Adkins pushed his patent through the patent office, issued in early 1960, and the complaint was filed on the same day.
The complaint asserts the first cause of action, asserting breach of license agreement of Exhibit 8 and unjust enrichment, and as a second cause of action, misappropriation of Adkins' ideas, discoveries, and inventions in violation of his common law rights. Now, the second cause of action was dismissed and was never tried. The trial court took the rule that Lear terminated the license agreement by this notice in 1959, and the jury returned a verdict for Adkins on the basis of both products, the California Model 2156 and the Michigan Steel Gyros. The trial court granted Lear's motion, notwithstanding the verdict, concerning the Michigan steel gyros, and it left the directed verdict concerning the California gyros stand. The trial court said that Lear's not estopped to contest validity with respect to the Michigan steel gyros because they were independently developed, also because the claims of the patent do not cover the Michigan steel gyros. And also, the patent is invalid, as far as that trial court is concerned, as failing to meet the constitutional standard required for patentability, relying upon the A&P case of this court. Well, the Intermediate Appellate Court in California ruled generally along the same lines. I won't discuss it, because that decision is rendered a nullity of when the California Supreme Court takes the case. California Supreme Court held that this termination was ineffective because of this implied condition that we've just mentioned. It then adopted the defense of licensee estoppel, which was asserted by Adkins, and held that Lear was estopped to contest the validity of the patent and was liable for royalties. It also used some criteria in ascertaining the scope of the invention and infringement that we feel are clearly in violation of decisions of this court, for example. Well, under the decision of the California Supreme Court, Lear has two alternatives. One is to pay royalties regardless of patent invalidity and failure of consideration, or cease manufacturing the devices. It's deprived of the alternative of continuing the manufacture of the products purportedly covered by the claims of Adkins' patent application and challenging validity. And this renders any licensee that challenges validity vulnerable to suit for infringement and imposition of damages which may be of much greater magnitude than those imposed under an agreement. So a licensee has to be very well advised before he wants to take such a step. Well, now the issues, or the major questions before this court are...
Well, don't you have to treat the Michigan steel gyro problem as a license to use... know-how or an unpatented article?
No, Your Honor.
Why do you talk about that one in terms of patent law? That's the question I put to you initially, yes. And it still bothers me.
Well, Your Honor, you're going right to the crux of one of the issues in this case, and that is, are any common law rights involved here? Patents and common law rights are mutually exclusive.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at, yes, sir. Because
yes.
I really don't understand it, and I couldn't disentangle it from your brief.
Yes. Well, Your Honor, the agreement is explicit. And this agreement superseded, canceled all other agreements. Lear, for example, wanted to go into things of that nature, and it presented an exhibit U for admission and evidence under an offer of proof at Reporter's Transcript 1018, where Atkins says, in representations leading up to the license agreement, "It is impossible for me to give Lear a license on claims which may not be allowed or are not patentable." Now, evidence along this line was excluded by the trial court. The trial court said, you're under this agreement, and this agreement limits you to patented or patentable things, and not secret ideas, not discoveries, nothing unpatentable is covered. And as a matter of fact, Your Honor, there was a waiver just before trial of all causes of action other than the issues raised by the license agreement. So all ideas are out of the picture. Know-how is out of the picture. The license agreement doesn't mention know-how in any place, nor does it mention ideas. The only thing it mentions are things that are patented or patentable. And hence, we submit that brings that directly under the federal criteria concerning patent matters. Well, the major questions before this court are the enforceability of such an agreement containing a restraint, which is outside the scope of the rights provided by the patent laws. Number two, the applicability of licensee estoppel under the circumstances of this case, and as a general principle. Whether the claims of Atkins' patent application are really unpatentable and invalid as a matter of law, like the Superior Court of the State of California held. And as question number four, whether the ground rules in enforcing a patent under a license agreement are the same as they are in enforcing a patent in an infringement action. And the California Supreme Court didn't use the same ground rules. Otherwise, they could have never held that the Michigan steel gyros are covered by the claims of the patent. Well, as to question number one, the enforceability of such an agreement, the requirement that Lear cease manufacturing the products covered by the license agreement in order to terminate is not a right granted by the patent laws. Mere pendency of a patent application provides no vested rights. In fact, patent may never issue. And this, we submit, is similar to the situation in Brulotti versus Ties, where this court held that an agreement which attempts to extend patent rights beyond the 17-year period, patents are good for 17 years, and if the patent is attempted to be extended beyond that period, it's an improper use of patent rights. We submit that the very same considerations apply here, where the patent rights are attempted to be extended before they really issue. We submit that this such a provision, which is the California Supreme Court found was implied in the agreement, renders it unenforceable. Such an unwarranted extension of patent rights is particularly objectionable here, where products affected are military equipment. This is because of the policy embodied in 28 U.S.C. 1498, which permits use by the government of all inventions without possibility of injunction. It also safeguards government from Payment of royalties on specious patents. Because validity can always be attacked. Now, with reference to the second major question concerning estoppel, the government has filed a brief as amicus curiae urging that this court should completely reject any doctrine of licensee estoppel. I'm advised that counsel for the government, Mr. Wallace, will direct his oral argument to the broad grounds, and accordingly I will discuss the circumstances of this case. Under the circumstances of this case, Lear specifically renounced any liability. It renounced liability with respect to the Michigan steel gyros in 1957. It renounced liability under the whole agreement as of 1959. This placed Atkins in the position that he could have charged Lear as an infringer if he had so desired. He elected to bring suit for royalties. And he relies very heavily on the Hazeltine case in support of his position. Well, in the Hazeltine case, there was no renouncement of the license agreement prior to the suit against Hazeltine. They just didn't pay royalties, didn't make royalty reports. This was all brought out in the lower court decisions. Under the Hazeltine case, the licensor didn't have the right to sue for infringement. There was an outstanding agreement. The party simply had not paid royalties. Here, Lear has renounced, and Atkins had a choice. He chose to proceed under the agreement, and the various cases cited in our brief show that under such circumstances, where there's a renouncement, assertion of failure consideration, Lear has the right to challenge the validity of that patent. The Dale Tile Company case is one along this line, and the amount of the judgment on the California Model 2156 gyros was a little over $16,000. On the Michigan steel gyros, it was almost $900,000. It was $888,000, I believe. Now, that was as of 1963, Your Honor, which was a period agreed upon for accounting purposes only. And, of course, the same thing applies today. It's been going on. Lear is doing the same thing today it was doing in 1963. Well, the defense of failure of consideration is a well-established defense in contract matters, and that's what Lear asserted. And that's a defense of record in the trial court, in the pleadings. And we submit that the doctrine of licensee estoppel should not override such a well-known and undisputed defense. Second circumstance of this case was that the license to Lear was granted under a patent application that was altered by amendment. Numerous amendments were filed in this application, and as I've pointed out, one of major importance was filed in December 1958, which changed the tenor of things. Patent issued with claims Lear had never seen. To invoke a rule of estoppel under such circumstances gives the licensor of a patent application the right to change the gist of his invention, cover products that weren't originally considered to be covered. It, in essence, places the licensee at the mercy of the licensor with no means for redress. So we submit that licensee estoppel should not apply If the agreement is based upon a patent application, which is in fact changed, which is in fact amended from time to time after execution of the agreement. The third circumstance of this case is that the, as I've already mentioned, the license agreement, as construed by the California Supreme Court, embodies an implied condition for termination that requires Lear to cease manufacturing the products of the agreement in order to terminate it. As this court held in McGregor versus Westinghouse, the rule of licensee estoppel cannot be used as a shield to preclude investigation of the validity of a patent, where in the absence of a valid patent, it would be a restraint of trade. And certainly that's a circumstance here. The requirement that Lear cease manufacturing the devices as a restraint of trade and licensee estoppel should not be employed as a shield to prevent Lear from defenses concerning this issue. Any one of these three circumstances is sufficient to override any estoppel, if any vestige of the doctrine still survives, and Mr. Wallace will discuss that on behalf of the government. Now, Lear's third and fourth questions relate to the validity and the scope of Atkins' patent. These are always interrelated because if the patent is of a certain scope, then the claims must not read on the prior art, or otherwise it's rendered invalid. And these two questions require an understanding of the bearing supporting apparatus of the Michigan steel gyros and the California Model 2156 gyros, and I think perhaps this will help clarify some of the questions that Mr. Justice Fortas was raising earlier. The alignment arrangements, if I may ask the court to refer to figure 9 of Lear's reply brief at page 50. The two alignment arrangements are shown there in simplified form.
Whose reply brief did you say?
Lear's reply brief, Your Honor. It's the gray covered, fairly small brief. Towards the end at page 50, you will find two figures illustrating Atkins' patent and one figure illustrating the Michigan steel gyro. Now, Atkins' patent shows a bearing supporting apparatus which employs a cone-shaped seat in a gimbal housing and spherical-shaped bearing cups. And the patent states that those elements are shown at both the top and bottom of the figures concerning Atkins' patent, and I will elaborate on that a little more in a moment. The patent states that the bearings may be aligned by placing them on a jig or mandrel and then placing them in the bearing receiving elements, as we've illustrated. When the mandrel is rotated, it causes the bearings to become aligned, and this is accommodated by the engaging surfaces between the cylindrical-shaped bearing cups and the cone-shaped seats in view of their different curved shapes. I'm quoting more or less from the patent, I believe exactly from it. Now, at the trial, we used this demonstration to illustrate the two types of surfaces we're talking about. The cone-shaped seats are the two seats in the framework that's shown on figure 9. And the other members are spherical shape. They're a portion of a sphere, and we have illustrated this by a piece of a croquet ball. This shows the type of action that Atkins used in order to achieve alignment. It provides and the so-called angular tilt that you'll see referred to in the briefs due to the two surfaces that are involved that accommodate this kind of movement. Now, we have a model here in court showing the alignment of the bearings in accordance with Atkins' patent. This was demonstrated at the trial, and I think it's essential, if the court will bear with me, I believe it's essential for a thorough understanding of the issue of scope of the patent and patent application that are involved in this action. So Mr. Hartz will demonstrate this model. It's approximately four times the actual size of the actual parts in reality. It shows a cone shaped seat like the funnel that I just demonstrated. It has bearing cups with a spherical surface. This is a spherical surface, much like the croquet ball that I demonstrated. It has bearings for mounting in the bearing cups, which ultimately go into the seats, which are in the framework.
Mr. Hale, I want to be sure I understand the relationship between what's being demonstrated here and the diagrams opposite page 50 of the reply brief. What is it?
This is the left-hand portion, Atkins patent. The Atkins patent and the California model 2156 gyro was very similar, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. It has the cone-shaped member here, the spherical-shaped member here for receiving the bearing element. This is very much like the top thing that's shown on the first one. As you can see, there's a small cutaway there. Now, the patent says these bearings are slid on a jigger mandrel, which may be a cylindrical rod. This jigger mandrel is simply an assembly tool, which is taken out later. And we will demonstrate that. The bearings are then placed into the bearing cups, and they in turn, of course, are in the framework in their cone-shaped seats. The mandrel is rotated, and due to the nature of the engaging surfaces, which permit this type of movement, alignment is achieved. As soon as that's done, cement is placed around there to hold them in place. The patent states that other arrangements can be used, like screws or welding, what have you. Thereafter, the jig is removed and the gyro is then ready to put together in final form. Now, the alignment of the Michigan steel gyros is illustrated in the far right-hand corner of figure 9, and we will now demonstrate that. Here is the jig, which appears in the center of figure 9. This is taken from Exhibit O that was admitted in evidence and is part of the assembly procedure that's been throughout this trial. Here's the little mandrel or jig as actually employed in production in the Michigan steel gyro. You will notice that one end has a little bearing cup on it, and the other end, I'll put one on right now. These fit snugly, and not only that, but they're fixed by screws and washers, so that they are absolutely rigid, those bearing cups, when they're mounted on this. And they're now in alignment, right now, no matter what you do with them. Those bearing cups are in alignment and will stay that way. No angular motion, no tilt. They're in alignment.
Now, where's the mandrel?
The mandrel is this portion here, Your Honor, and here are the two
bearing cups.
We have a larger model. It'll be easier for the court to see.
Mm-hmm. What's an arbor? Is that the same as a mandrel?
Yes, Your Honor. These terms have all been used interchangeably. I feel compelled to use them more or less interchangeably.
mandrel or arbor or jig, all three mean the same thing.
That's right. Now, here's the characteristic structure of the bearing cups in the Michigan steel gyros. It's the total thing has been sometimes characterized as a cylindrical top hat placed in a loose hole, loosely fitting hole. Here it's loose. Going to assemble that. Show the court just exactly how the alignment is achieved. Again, this is approximately 4 times scale.
What is that? Is that actual scale? Actual
this
size?
Is four times.
Four times
scale.
Mm-hmm.
For the benefit of.
In his right hand is the actual.
And also,
well,
Your Honor,
we have
here in court the actual housings that the mandrel goes into. I may demonstrate that it goes into a loose hole on this end, loose hole on this end. The thing is cemented in place or welded or what have you, and then the mandrel can be removed. It's ready for final assembly. And here's the package that's ready, if you will.
And that's actual size that you have in your hand?
Yes, Your Honor. That's right out of the production line. Well, the characteristic of alignment in the Michigan steel gyros still uses a mandrel like the California model 2156, but that's about the end of the resemblance, and that mandrel is taken out, not used. Atkins tried to get claims covering the procedure for alignment, the way I've just demonstrated on the model 2156. He tried and tried and tried, and he was turned down every time on his method claims, and he canceled those. We submit that puts them in the public domain, and he cannot now claim that that the method is the same, that the two employ the same thing. The California Supreme Court said it wasn't obligated to look at the file history concerning these aspects because the claims that were presented in that application were brand new. They were presented down at the very end of the prosecution. Well, we submit that that's not the law. The criteria that's been established by this court and many other courts say you have to look at the whole file history in order to ascertain what the claims really mean. The California Supreme Court in interpreting the scope of Atkins' patent, the California Supreme Court said, the device of cemented end bearing cups using a mandrel procedure constitutes the essence of Atkins' invention, as described in his application. Well, that's the essence of his invention. It's in the public domain because he canceled that, the method and the mandrel procedure. The language I've just quoted from is in Appendix A1-192. So this is one of the criteria that we feel that the California Supreme Court applied improperly. Another major thing was that the California Supreme Court states the alignment of bearing cups in either Atkins or the steel gyros can be accomplished only by the angular displacement of the two cups to the axis of the mandrel. Well, if it please the court, it's impossible for either of these two cups to be displaced to the axis of the mandrel. It's an absolute physical impossibility. And we submit that that's a major error. If I may, Court, I would like to refer now to our opening brief. I believe that's blue. At figure 4, which is opposite page 57. Figure 4-2, sets forth the main claim of Adkins' patent application and the patent which issued, which is illustrated here. I will refer to the figures since the print is a little small here, but I would like to point out that the letters A, B, and C identify the three elements of this invention, and Adkins admits that those three elements are old in the art. He simply says they have a new cooperative relationship. But when he applies this new cooperative relationship, he isn't talking about things in the claim. And it's the claim that defines the invention. Now, this is one of the exhibits employed in the trial court, and I use it only for the purpose of illustration. It's the left-hand figure of Exhibit 4-1. I've just referred the court to. I would like to point out that the color code on all of these things is the same. Red means bearing cups and so forth. And you'll see here a red element, a bearing cup, designated a bearing receiving frame, B, and means for holding that bearing cup in place, designated C. Now, the bearing receiving element is in a sloppy hole, in a loosely fitting hole, just like the Michigan steel gyros. And alignment is achieved by use of this feature. Now, I will rely...
This is what, prior art?
Yes, Your Honor. This goes to the issue of validity and scope. If Adkins' claims read on this Michigan steel gyro, as I've just demonstrated, they also read right on this.
On the Schwann patent, which is prior art.
Yes, Your Honor. And yes, also on several others. And if I may, Mr. Chief Justice, I believe I have about 5 minutes left I'd like to reserve.
You may. Mr. Wallace, is he... That's...
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The United States believes that the time has come for this court to hold that the most fundamental policies of the federal patent and antitrust laws forbid the application in state or federal courts of doctrines of estoppel which result in court enforcement of invalid patent monopolies.
Was that issue necessarily decided in the...
We believe it was,
and is it
Your
necessarily
Honor,
here?
We believe it is necessarily.
Unavoidably?
We believe that it is before this court, and if you like, Your Honor, I'll turn directly to that problem since respondent raises this contention in its brief in this court. Respondent contends that the estoppel issue is not before this court because Lear never claimed in the state courts that federal law gave it the right to contest the validity of the patent. But in our examination of the briefs that have been certified to this court as a part of the record, We see that Lear did make this claim based on federal law in the briefs. I believe the clearest example can be found on pages 25 through 28 of Lear's reply brief in the District Court of Appeal in California, which under California practice also becomes the brief in the Supreme Court. Litigants are forbidden from filing new briefs in the Supreme Court of California. This portion of Lear's brief has not been reproduced in the printed appendix, but it has been certified by the clerk as a part of the record, and it is on file with the clerk in this court. And let me just summarize for you why I think this is a clear example, and the government thinks this is a clear example, of the petitioners having raised the federal issue before the state courts. Beginning on page 25 of that reply brief, the petitioner refers to the provisions of Article 1 of the Federal Constitution.
Do we have that in these papers that we have? Is it included in the appendix or anywhere?
No, they have not. This has not been reprinted in the appendix.
So we do not have that at all.
You don't have it among your papers.
Right.
That is correct, sir. But it is on file with the clerk here as a part of the record that was not printed in the printed appendix.
That is on file here.
It is on file with the clerk of this court. Yes, Mr. Justice. But it was not printed in the appendix. Beginning on page, and this is pages 25 through 28 of that brief, the reply brief before the state appellate courts. Beginning on page 25, Lear referred to and quoted from Article 1 of the Federal Constitution, the Patent Clause, and then elaborated some of the provisions of the Patent Code which Congress has enacted. And then in the course of this particular contention, said a license or contract concerning patent applications and patents have more than the usual two interested parties. Patents from their inception have been designed to promote the progress of science and were instituted for the public's benefit and not as a reward for the inventor, citing an opinion of this court, Kendall against Windsor, in 21 Howard. This is followed by quotations from two other federal cases, one an opinion of this court, Precision Instrument Manufacturing Company case in 324 U.S., and then a Ninth Circuit case. And then finally, at the conclusion of this portion of the argument, the contention was put this way. In the present action, the trial court expressly found that plaintiff's patent attempts to cover something that is in the existing fund of public knowledge and something that would be obvious to one skilled in the art. Thus, plaintiff's patent is invalid. It does not provide protection for any device or product, and its validity with respect to the 2156 gyros can be contested by defendant and also by everyone else because of the public interest which is involved.
What page is it?
California Supreme Court
Yes, it did. It explicitly held that the patent estoppel doctrine is applicable. And
may I ask you first to give me the pages of that brief from which you just read? 25.
The pages are pages 25 through 28 of the reply brief submitted by Lear in the District Court of Appeal. This is the brief that refers to civil actions numbers 28624 and 30089. There were numerous briefs, but this is the reply brief. It's the brown-covered brief.
Of Lear.
Of Lear in the District Court of Appeal and also in the Supreme Court of California. Now, on page 191, of the first volume of your printed appendix, where you have the opinion of the Supreme Court of California, you have the holding in very explicit terms, right in the middle of page 191, the doctrine of licensee estoppel is applicable, and Lear is foreclosed from challenging the validity of Adkins' patent. Now, we are of the view...
Does it make any difference whether that's not a broad statement?
Well, we are of the view that since the question of federal law was presented to the court, and the court rejected that contention by applying the doctrine of estoppel, that this necessarily meant that the California Supreme Court passed on the question of federal law. Now, in the pages that I referred you to in the brief before the California court, we are of the view that because only federal authority are cited throughout these 3.5 pages, and the argument ends at that point, and a new point is taken up, the clear intendment of these pages of the brief is to raise this issue as a federal claim, and this was sufficient under the standard which this court applied in Braniff Airways Incorporated against the Nebraska State Board of Equalization in 347 U.S., where the clear intendment was to assert a federal claim. No precise terminology need be followed in presenting that claim so long as the state court does pass upon it. Now, it is true that this reply brief raising the issue was concerned only with the aspects of the case relating to the so-called California gyro, and not to the Michigan gyro. But it is also true that the state Supreme Court consolidated all aspects of the case together into one appeal and into one opinion, and thus had this federal claim before it and passed upon it for purposes of the entire case. But even in the absence of consolidation in the court below, the issue of licensee estoppel would still be before this court because a part of the judgment awarded is for royalties for manufacture of the California gyro, the claimed invention with respect to which this point was specifically raised. Well, in that case, the issue of the validity of the patent is still undecided. The petitioner has submitted this issue to this court. This court, in its discretion, could pass upon it or could remand the case for consideration of that and other issues that may still remain in the case by the state courts. It's on page 191 of volume 1 of the appendix, of the printed appendix, right in the middle of the page. It follows also that the doctrine of licensee estoppel is applicable and Lear is foreclosed from challenging the validity of Adkins' patent. Well, this is necessary to the decision, yes, sir, as we read the California decision. Therefore, the United States believes that the issue is before this court, and we have addressed ourselves to the issue of whether the licensee estoppel doctrine should now be eliminated in view of the weight and the teaching of this court's decisions in recent years, which have required exceptions to the doctrine, and which otherwise have closely confined court enforcement of monopolies to the limited scope authorized by the federal patent laws. Under our patent system, unlike that of some European countries, patent monopolies are granted in essentially ex parte, non-adversary administrative proceedings. And as this court and other courts and indeed Congress have had frequent occasion to observe, this system results in the issuance of numerous patents for articles which do not meet the requisite standard of invention upon later investigation, an adversary investigation. Therefore, as we show in our brief, the public interest is strongly dependent under our patent system on the availability of opportunities for private litigants to expose invalid patent monopolies before the courts in order to free the public from their economic effects. In many instances, a licensee may be the only potential litigant who combines the requisite knowledge with the requisite incentive to mount that challenge. The practicalities of the business situation may well have induced a licensee to enter into the license agreement even though he had doubts about the validity of the patent or had not had time to investigate the question of validity. For example, a government contractor, such as the petitioner, must assure himself before he submits his bid that he will be able to perform the contract. And this means that he must have a legal right to make and sell every component required. When some of those components are covered in issued patents or in patent applications, the pressure to enter into license agreements would seem obvious. The basic vice of the estoppel doctrine is that it converts those licenses into incontestable devices for the economic effectuation of invalid patent monopolies. Now, it is instructive to remember that this court's early recognition of the doctrine of patent licensee estoppel in the 1855 case of Kinsman against Parkhurst, and as we point out in our brief, it was a recognition, not a holding there. This occurred 35 years prior to the enactment of the Sherman antitrust law, when the patent laws were not yet viewed as a carefully confined exception to the broad interdiction of monopolization in the antitrust laws. And this court's first significant limitation of the estoppel doctrine in Pope Manufacturing Company against Gormley occurred in 1892, 2 years after the enactment of the Sherman law. Later, in the Sola Electric, Katzinger, and McGregor cases discussed in our brief, this court held that the estoppel doctrine may not be applied when the license agreement contains a price-fixing clause. And in Scott Paper Company against Marcalis Company, the court held that an assignor cannot be estopped from showing that he was not infringing the assigned patent because he was using only the prior art of an expired patent, even though in the circumstances this amounted to a showing that the patent he assigned had been anticipated and was therefore invalid. In his perceptive and candid dissenting opinions in those cases, Mr. Justice Frankfurter pointed out that the general doctrines of assignor estoppel and licensee estoppel really could not withstand the rationale of those decisions and ultimately would have to yield to the same considerations of the public interest that governed the court's decisions in those cases. But several years later, a majority of the court tersely reendorsed the general doctrine of licensee estoppel in the Hazeltine case and said that the previous cases meant that estoppel is forbidden only if the license attempts to enlarge the patent monopoly through price fixing, for example. But as Mr. Justice Douglas, joined by Mr. Justice Black, asked in dissent in that case, what more egregious enlargement of monopoly is there from the standpoint of public harm than the attachment of a patent monopoly to an unpatentable article? The majority opinion did not answer that question. The question remains unanswered, and the United States submits that the question is unanswerable. More recently, in the Sears, Roebuck against Stifel and Comco cases, this court held that the states cannot confer upon the originator of a design the power to exclude others from copying that design, that the power to exclude is the exclusive province of the federal patent laws and can attach only to a valid federal patent. Now, the power to exclude others from making, using, or selling, which is conferred by a patent, is often utilized by the patentee conditionally in order to reap economic rewards from the patent. He excludes others from using the product unless they buy it from him, or he excludes others from making and selling the product unless they pay him an agreed upon royalty. This is precisely the power to exclude which the decision below has given to the respondent, even if his patent is invalid. And California has thus used the doctrine of licensee estoppel to trespass upon the domain of the federal patent laws and to enlarge the impact on the economy of patent monopoly rights from that which is authorized by the federal laws, just as the Illinois law of unfair competition had been used in Stifel and Comco to trespass upon the federal domain and enlarge monopoly powers. In those cases, this court held that the states must be confined to remedies that are compatible with the policies of federal law, such as the requirement of labeling in that factual context. And likewise, here we have argued in the concluding pages of our brief that the states may devise remedies to do equity between businessmen which do not conflict with federal law, but the states should be barred from sacrificing the public interest by applying doctrines of estoppel that result in enforcement of monopolies that are not authorized by federal law. Only last term, in the Permalife Mufflers case, this court reiterated that we are dealing here in an area in which the court has often indicated the inappropriateness of invoking broad common law barriers to relief, where litigation serves important public interests. And so the United States asks this court in this case to relieve the people of this country of the burden of having to pay royalties for the use of non-inventions, and to give the people what the Constitution and the laws of Congress say is rightfully theirs, the free use of all the technology that is in the public domain.
Well, assuming that the Michigan patent here is invalid, and assuming that petitioner can avail itself of that point, does that, in your judgment, dispose of the claim with respect to compensation for the use of the Michigan device?
Well, the United States has not really formulated a position on that question.
Well, you're doing something more than asking us to make a ruling in the abstract here, aren't you?
Well, of course, there's no problem with the California device at all. With respect to the Michigan device,
there's no question about the California validity of the California patent, is there? In this case?
Yes, there was an estoppel applied with respect to both patents. And Lear was estopped from contesting the validity of either patent, and the judgment reflects royalties for the use of both patents.
But the judgment, has it been an adjudication that the Michigan patent is invalid in this case? It hasn't, has it?
No, there has
but
not.
There was such
because
an
the trial court held Lear estopped from the outset with respect to that.
There was an adjudication. Wasn't there an adjudication? Was it the intermediate court?
It was at the trial court that the Michigan device was held to be invalid.
Invalid at the trial court. So that we do have that difference in the posture of the case in any event between these two patents. And you made no study of the impact of accepting your theory with respect to whether a claim survives.
Well, I've made a study of it, but the United States has not taken a position with respect to that question.
Well, you haven't made a study that's helpful to us. Thank you. Well, isn't it true that that no royalties were payable except on patented or patentable articles under this agreement?
The agreement so stated, and the basis for the royalty payments having been awarded in the judgment of the California court is that Lear was estopped to contest the validity of either patent.
We'll research.
We are the court is now adjourned.
To the record, cost about a penny a piece. But that we claim is the only.
Well, let me see.
The only difference.
I guess Losi just wasn't used. Is that it?
Losi was used in the late 30s, and then wasn't used.
And that's all. And meanwhile, they were using other things.
Number 56, Lear Incorporated, petitioner versus John S. Atkins. Mr. Cullen, you may begin your argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. First, it is important to show in this case that Lear never properly raised or preserved the question of whether licensee estoppel violates either the patent laws or the antitrust laws. Although Mr. Wallace for the government referred the court to pages 25 to 28 of one of Lear's reply briefs, where Lear had quoted the constitutional standard for invention and the sections of the patent laws dealing with validity, he did not read far enough from that portion of the brief. In that section, after quoting those provisions, what Lear was arguing was only that the federal laws, including the constitutional standard, had to be applied in determining the question of validity. That portion did not in any way assert that the doctrine of licensee estoppel was invalid in that it violated either the patent laws or the antitrust laws. In fact, at page 75 of that same brief, Lear had a separate section dealing with the doctrine of licensee estoppel, in which Lear conceded that the doctrine was applicable in this case unless it fell within one of two exceptions, one being termination and the other being repudiation. I have Xeroxed copies of the brief that Mr. Wallace referred to, pages 18 through 26, and I have handed them to the clerk this morning for this court to consider if it so desires. I offer now a copy to the government.
What pages are those? These are
18 through 28. In fact, the government concedes in its amicus brief that the issue of whether or not the doctrine of licensee estoppel violates either the patent laws or the antitrust laws was not timely raised or preserved in this case. At page 8, the government says as follows, quote, "This court need not be deterred from reaching this issue, licensee estoppel, by the fact that petitioners' contentions in the state courts were directed primarily to attempting to carve out an exception to the doctrine rather than to its overturn. Because of this court's decision upholding the doctrine in Automatic Radio Co. versus Hazeltine, it would have been futile for the petitioner to argue broadly to the state courts that federal law bars the states from applying the doctrine of patent licensee estoppel. Moreover, Lear has conceded in the state court system that the rule of licensee estoppel was applicable unless Lear fell within one of two state exceptions. The best statement of this concession appears at page 109 of Lear's answering brief in the California District Court, which is quoted at page 120 of the appendix before this court, and which states as follows, quote, "It is a recognized principle of law that when a license agreement provides a grant of a right to either manufacture, use, or sell a product incorporating a patented invention, the licensee is estopped to contest the validity of the licensed patent only so long as the licensee is operating under the license. This is not only the modern rule, as plaintiff likes to call it, but is also the old rule as well. This rule was set out in the 1939 case of the Armstrong Co. versus the Shell Company of California, which was a California court opinion." Lear then goes on to say, "This estoppel lasts only so long as the licensee operates under the license agreement. This estoppel arises not because of the express terms in the agreement, but because the licensee is using and enjoying the benefit and protection of the right covered by the agreement and should not be permitted to reap the benefits of the agreement and at the same time contest the validity of the patents to show failure of consideration for the agreement."
What appendix are you reading from?
Appendix number 1. To the briefs on the merits, and this appears at page 120.
Appendix number 1.
Should be volume 1, appendix volume 1.
There's no question, I guess. The Supreme Court, the state court, did rely on estoppel to dispose of this case to some extent.
Yes, it did rely on it to
and
a certain
your
extent.
Point is that no one ever really raised the question of whether federal law forbade the state court to rule that way.
That's correct. It was never raised in the state system whatsoever.
What about the passage in the brief that was read to us yesterday?
The passage in the brief that was read to you yesterday was dealing primarily, in fact exclusively, with the constitutional standard and the patent laws insofar as they concern the standard for invention. There was nothing said there about licensee estoppel, and particularly nothing said about whether it violates either the antitrust laws or the patent laws. That section was dealing solely with the validity question and what the standard was for determining the validity of a patent. I think this is clear from page 28, where after quoting the constitutional provision and the patent standard set forth in sections 101, 102, 103, and subsequent sections, they conclude that this test must be applied in determining validity, but there's no statement there concerning licensee estoppel or whether those standards have to be applied in determining whether the doctrine of licensee estoppel violates either the patent laws or the antitrust laws.
I don't exactly understand what it is you say they did not raise with specificity.
What I'm saying they did not raise with any specificity was the question of whether the doctrine of licensee estoppel per se violates either the policy of the antitrust laws or the policy of the patent laws. This question was never raised in the trial court or in the appellate court.
Did they raise the question of what law governs, state or federal, in the trial of the case?
Not on this issue, because this issue was never raised. It was, I assume, just conceded that the doctrine was applicable whether or not it was state law. But
well, if it was decided, we can decide it here.
If it was decided, assuming it is essential to the decision, and it is essential to the decision only in a very narrow respect, but I would assume that if it hadn't been properly raised, that it would not be properly before this court.
Even if the court decided
it? I would assume that the court had decided it as a question of state law because it was not raised as a federal question. And in trying to carve out exceptions to the doctrine, in that Lear had claimed that it had either terminated or repudiated the agreement, Lear stated that these were state exceptions to the doctrine. So that I would gather that it was more or less assumed all the way along the line that what was being applied was a state doctrine, since it was never questioned under the federal laws in any way.
You say assumed all along the line. That's been a hot legal controversy for years, hasn't it, in all the courts?
It has been a controversy before this court, yes, but it arose in this case in the context that Lear conceded the applicability of the rule and then contended only that they fell within two so-called state exceptions, that they had either terminated the agreement.
They conceded that the state law governed on that point?
They conceded that the doctrine of licensee estoppel was applicable without saying any place in the state system, whether it was state or federal, but by the fact that they tried to use so-called state exceptions to come without the rule, they probably also conceded that it was a state doctrine, although I admit that it was never specified which one it was.
You mean they conceded that point?
Yes, Your Honor.
The licensee was barred because he'd been a licensee
what they
raising the validity of the patent?
That's right. What they conceded...
Is that in the pleading? Did they do that in an answer?
No, they did not do that in the pleadings. They did this in a brief on appeal and also in a brief in the trial court, in which they conceded the applicability of the doctrine of licensee estoppel and sought to bring themselves within two exceptions thereto.
They conceded the validity of it under any law. Did they ever concede the validity of it under any law?
I would have to assume they did because they never questioned that it was applicable.
Where in the record can I find it?
I can refer you to page 120 of the appendix.
Is that all? Appendix number one.
Appendix number one, yes. And also, volume one, yes.
That's what you read before?
That's correct.
Well, I read that a moment ago, and I didn't... Maybe I had the wrong one.
On page 120, Your Honor.
Well, that wouldn't necessarily preclude us, would it? Assuming that they had not... press the point below, that wouldn't preclude us from deciding the issue, would it? This is not an issue that... This is about as plain an issue of law law pure and simple. There's any such thing as one could readily imagine.
Well, I would assume that under the procedural rules that have been laid down by this court, that unless the issue is timely raised as a federal question, it is too late to raise it in this court. Now, it went through the entire California system without any question to the applicability of the doctrine. There was no federal question presented. Rather, there was only an attempt to carve out state exceptions to this rule on the theory that Lear had either terminated the agreement by sending notice of termination or had repudiated the agreement. And on both those issues, Lear took the position that that was state law. And since they were applying it to the doctrine of licensee estoppel, I would assume that they also...
Well, I don't want to take any more of your time, but certainly there were plenty of federal questions raised below, and your point, I take it, is that assuming that this particular argument was not made below, is it too late to make this particular argument here?
Well, I think it is, because the only federal questions that were raised below were in connection with the application of the federal standards for patentability, which never really became an issue in the California Supreme Court because it applied the doctrine of licensee estoppel. So unless the court can reach the issue of licensee estoppel, it can't go any further than that. And if that's decided solely on a state ground as a matter of state contract law, then the federal patent issues which were raised never arise in this case.
You said, if I understood you, that the estoppel, claimed estoppel of the patentee related only to part of the issues in this case. Is that right?
Yes, that is only part of the issues.
Will you tell us about that sometime in the course of your argument?
What the other issues are?
Yes.
The other issue was primarily the construction of the contract and Lear's attempts to avoid the contract by saying that it either terminated or repudiated, and thereby get itself into the federal court system in a pure suit for infringement. And the California Supreme Court devoted a good part of its time to determining whether or not Lear had terminated the contract.
Do you agree or disagree that this contract has to be construed and applied solely from the point of view of a patent license contract?
No, I don't think it does, because I don't think it is in the pure and technical sense a patent contract. It relates to patent events to a certain extent, but it is more concerned with a bargain for the disclosure of an invention in return for the payment of a royalty for the disclosure of that invention. That is the real basis of that bargain, which I will get to as I get further into my argument. Now, just as the issue relating to the question of licensee estoppel is not properly before this court, in my opinion, similarly, the issue of patent validity is not before this court for several reasons. First, if the issue of licensee estoppel is not before this court, it cannot reach this dependent question. Second, the issue of validity was not one of the five questions presented in Lear's petition for certiorari. It is also, third, not a necessarily included question under Rule 23.1c. Fourth, the California Supreme Court did not consider the issue of validity, and under settled procedural rules, this court will not normally pass on questions in the first instance without the lower courts having first undertaken to decide those issues. In fact, the government urges at page 26 of its amicus brief that if the issue of validity must be reached, that the case should be remanded to the California Supreme Court for consideration of this issue. Consequently, in my view, because the doctrine of licensee estoppel was never properly raised as a federal issue, and the doctrine of the validity of the patent is consequently not before the court, the result should be that this petition be dismissed as improvidently granted.
Okay.
Well, what I think it was doing was using that it decided on state grounds because it did so in connection with the construction of an agreement. And although it used the words licensee estoppel or the doctrine of licensee estoppel, it was really using those words as a shorthand method of summing up what it had already determined on the contract, namely... That's right. I would assume that Walker cites probably state cases and federal cases as well. I would assume he does, but in those cases it may well have been that what the federal court was doing was applying local law in a diversity case on a contract action. Of course, I wouldn't know that reading the case, but... When you say that federal law governed, that the doctrine is a federal doctrine rather than a state doctrine, licensee estoppel, I've been assuming all along that the doctrine is one of state
law.
Oh, I think federal limitations would have to control the doctrine. This court has held that. But that is only in the misuse situation. I think what it was doing was saying, was one interpreting the contract and then saying as a shorthand method that what they're really saying is licensee estoppel really means that Lear is estopped to question the bargain that it freely entered into, in that in making the bargain, it did not make conclusive validity of the patent one of the considerations for the bargain. And therefore, since invalidity of the patent would not cause a failure of consideration, it should not be a defense. In other words, the parties never bargained with respect to the validity of the patent, and therefore it should not be a defense if it's invalid, because it could not affect the bargain of the parties. Correct. Whether they may go too far because of an overriding federal policy, but we're confined to the narrow situation and there's no misuse of the patent, and I think it remains just a state question until there is some transgression of the antitrust laws, perhaps the patent laws, but I really don't see how the patent laws come into play here, especially in the context of this case, because the bargain was really not for, quote, patents or patent rights. The essence of the bargain, as I will get to in a minute, was that Lear received a disclosure from Atkins of an idea, discovery, and invention for which they agreed to pay him as long as they continued to use it, subject to three conditions subsequent. Now, those conditions subsequent were, one, if no patent issued, two, if a patent issued with claims which did not cover the inventions they were using in the 2156 California gyro and the Michigan steel gyros, and three, if the patent was held invalid in third-party action. So although they tied these escape hatches to what might happen under the patent laws, they were really just a way of reducing Lear's liability under the agreement to continue to pay until the expiration of the patent. And since none of these conditions has occurred, they're, of course, still under the bargain.
Oh, yes, but didn't the license agreement just cover patented or patentable devices?
Well, it did say that in paragraph 2A.
Well, we just ignore that?
No, I'm not suggesting
that. Well,
don't we
have to determine then? Doesn't somebody before Lear's liable have to determine that these devices were either patented or patentable?
Well, I think you first have to read paragraph 2A with paragraph 1B. in order to determine what Lear was in effect licensed.
So you say that by doing that, Lear may be forced to pay even though it's determined that none of the devices are patentable.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that when you read paragraph 2A with paragraph 1B, what Lear licensed was the invention disclosed or intended to be disclosed. And by use of the words, if patentable, they were bargaining for what the patent office might do or what some third party might do to the patent and third party adjudication. But they were not bargaining that they themselves could contest the validity of the patent and thereby avoid the bargain. In other words, they were saying, in effect, that if the patent doesn't issue, or if the claims don't cover what we're making, or a third party holds it invalid and therefore can use it free, that we should also be able to use it free. And under those conditions only we can terminate. But the validity between us is decided by what the patent office will do in the first instance in issuing or not issuing a patent.
That's a question of federal law. The patent is a federal creation. The state of California couldn't issue a patent, could it?
No, there's no question about that.
So we're dealing with the federal domain right from the beginning.
We're not for this reason, in my view, and that is when they tied their bargain to patentability, they were tying it
to a federal concept,
to that standard, but only for one purpose, not to control the rights vis-a-vis Atkins and Lear, but to let Lear out of the contract in the event that a patent didn't issue and somebody else could therefore use it. In other words, their bargain